joining us today for our regular home improvement show. Larry Mueller here, and our topic today we're going to zero in a bit on is your home and mold with our guest John Freiberger back with us, registered home inspector. More than 50 years of experience, John's firm is Freiberger & Associates, and they consult in restoring and adapting old homes and other buildings. And we want to hear from you as we move along today. Have you noticed the buildup of moisture anywhere in your home? Let us know how you've removed mold, maybe. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. John Freiberger, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back, Larry.
You know, I'm sure mold is on the minds of several thousand homeowners, given the wet flooding that we had. But mold is kind of with us even without that flood sort of situation.
That's correct, Larry. There's been a lot of testing over the years, and there's been some pretty big studies, like the Iowa mold study. There was a big study in Montana. There's a big study in Portland, Oregon, another one in the state of Washington. And what you do is you air test for mold. So basically, you get this little suction fan, and you suck a known volume of air in cubic meters across a filter, and then you look at the filter. And in basically every instance, if you test the outside air and then test the inside air has more mold than the outside air, even on a day like this.
Yeah.
So that means our houses grow mold.
Oh. Well, as I understand it, dormant mold is always around in our house, is it not?
That is correct. Yeah, mold is dormant a lot of the time. We have to have either liquid water or some molds, like aspergillus, will grow at 85% humidity. Now, I've heard some scientists say there's some molds that actually grow at 60%, but I don't know enough about that to comment. But just high humidity itself can cause mold growth.
As I think about where it would grow, one thing that comes to mind is the bathroom and the shower and that area. But is that the most common, or what are the most common places where you're going to see mold?
Well, yes, the bathroom is probably the most common and one of the least troublesome.
Huh?
Well, because what happens in the bathroom is, you know, we've got old skin we sloughed off and all kinds of things mold can eat. Plus, we get high humidity. We take a shower. We don't leave the fan run long enough. So we get mold on the surface. And then we bring in some cleaner and we wipe it up and it's gone, right? So, yeah, it grows there. And we'll see it. We'll see these little green, gray, blue blotches. And, well, and of course, you know, we get a paper towel and the Windex bottle or the Resolve or whatever, and it's gone. The stuff that's pernicious, Larry, is the stuff we can't see. And it's the stuff that's inside our walls, inside our crawl spaces, inside our attics. That is the stuff that'll get you because you don't know that it's there.
Yeah. So, and it needs moisture.
Yes.
And most of us, do we have dehumidifiers, or is there a need for dehumidification in most of our houses these days, given the kinds of ways that we try to tighten them up?
Yeah. Well, in the summer in Wisconsin, with as hot as it is and as humid as it is outside, we run a lot of AC. So the AC, as a secondary benefit, does do some dehumidification. But basically, we really want our houses from 35 to 45%. Now, somebody say, John, what should it be? I'm going to say 40%. And some people may say that's too high or that's too low, but I think that that actually works. But we really need to keep the inside air fairly dry so that the air that's inside our walls, inside our attic, etc., is not too wet so that we don't get condensation.
Yeah, so keep the condensation out. At 35, 40%, you're going to have a pretty good chance of doing that?
Yes, you are. And certainly in the winter, and we all have windows in our house, and in the winter, there are days when we're going to see condensation.
Yeah.
And if we're seeing condensation at 20 below zero, that doesn't bother me at all. Or that glass is so cold that it is going to condense water out of 20% relative humidity air. So that's not a big worry. But if it's 25 degrees and you're seeing condensation on your windows, you've got a problem. Now, the best thing to do is go to the hardware store, spend $12 and buy a humidistat. Nice little digital humidistat, stick it on the wall, look at it occasionally. You may have a smart thermometer that's telling you what the humidity is. Yeah, 50% of the time they're wrong.
Well, so a humidistat.
A humidistat, just plain old
designed
humidistat.
Designed for that.
Yep, and take a look at it once a day, see what's going on in your house. And, of course, depending upon the type of house you have, the seasonal changes can be immense or they can be minimal.
Yeah.
Depends upon how well sealed your house is.
Yeah. Jen in Madison has a question relating to moisture. Let's go there. Jen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I always find out I have questions I didn't know about every time I listen to your show. thank you for your show today. I have a new problem, which I noticed that there was dripping over my stove from the hood. So I took the filter off and saw that there was condensation built up all inside there.
Mm-hmm.
What should I do about that?
Was that now or is that in the winter?
That's now.
That's now. Well, that's interesting. So your hood, for some reason, is colder than the air. So it's what we call a first condensing surface. So the first condensing surface is the solid surface where the temperature is such that the humidity in the air will turn into droplets of water. It's sort of a difficult concept, but first condensing surface. Because like if you think of your walls, Larry, the first condensing surface isn't always a drywall or plaster on the inside. That's often perfectly dry, and it's not the insulation. The first condensing surface is often the backside of the exterior sheathing.
Yeah.
So Jill, this is a little bit of a puzzle because it's warm right now. If you'd been calling at the December show, I'd go, well, we've got a lot of cold in there. It's condensing out. So I'm afraid I can't really answer that for you.
Well, I was thinking, well, why not run the fan more?
Well, certainly that would help, but it also brings, of course, more humidity in contact with the first condensing surface. So I think the first thing we want to do, Jim, is go down to the hardware store and buy a humidistat. And let's see what the humidity is in your house. And is the humidity so high that just a somewhat cooler piece of metal is going to cause condensation?
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of right now.
So for $12, you can get a humidistat or thereabouts.
Yep, nice little digital one.
And then if it's showing more than 40%.
Well, yeah, if it's, depending upon what's it showing, it might be showing 75%.
Yeah.
To have droplets of water forming in on a steel duct in a fairly temperate house. So, and I can't think of what would make, we'll go into people's basements when they have the AC running, and we'll find water dripping off the bottom of the heat ducts.
Yeah.
Because the heat duct's 65 degrees and the basement's 75 degrees and the relative humidity is 80%. But what is happening in Jem's house, I don't have a good answer for that. So start by investigating what your humidity is and then see what happens.
All right.
As Larry said, go ahead and just turn the fan on. Watch it for 10 minutes. And make sure it's water.
Yeah.
Is that clear congealed grease, that was a vapor? So, take the old Windex bottle and paper towel and wipe it out and see what it is.
Yeah.
But sorry, we can't give you any more than that.
Jen, good luck with that. Appreciate the call. Mark in Wisconsin Rapids has a question. Let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have an older farmhouse built in about 1930s that we've done a lot of work on to seal up and just energy efficiency. 4 years ago, I put in a new furnace, runs on LP, and a heat pump to supplement that. And it's really done a nice job of cutting my LP bill by almost 50%. But the problem I have is the upstairs is probably 10 degrees warmer than the first floor. And, I had somebody in, and there is a adequate amount of venting or cool air coming in the summer when we need it. but it never seems to be sufficient to cool the upstairs down. And I'm just looking for answers. What's the best way to try to cool off the top floor? And somebody has said a split something or other.
Yeah, a split back. But you already have a nice system. What we have to do is make the system work. Now, we know that warm air rises. Even in Wisconsin Rapids, where sometimes there isn't much warm air rises. And what we have in a modern house is we have air returns on the first floor and on the second floor. Now, your house is old enough. It was built before air conditioning. So there was no reason. All you had in your house when it was built in 1930 was a cold air return on the first floor because the heat rose to the second floor, and the second floor was nice and toasty in the winter. Well, it's also toasty in the summer because we're not getting the hot air out of it. So what we're doing is we're trying to push cold air in there, but we're getting resistance because you're trying to pressurize it. So what we need to do is find some way of getting a cold air duct. Now, what I find in a lot of old houses is the chimney is no longer necessary because you got a side-vented water heater, you got a side-vented furnace or a heat pump. So the chimney is just sitting there. So let's take the chimney out. That gives us a nice, useful 2-foot by 2-foot hole in our house. And that is a great place to put in a second floor air return.
Oh.
I don't know if that works.
Does that work for you, Mark? Have you got a chimney there?
A couple of years ago when we put a second bathroom upstairs, we took the chimney out and we used the chimney to bring in hot air up to the second floor. So that's not going to work.
Well, you're just going to probably have to find another place. And you can use an outside wall. It is not ideal because of the insulation issues. But we, through the 1950s, we had return air in outside walls. And then we suddenly switched everything about 1965. So you're just going to have to find some way of getting a duct up there so you can depressurize the second floor so the cold air you're attempting to pump up there will actually get there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your task, Mark. Go to it. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Our guest today, John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll talk about mass timber buildings. It's a construction style that uses wood to build skyscrapers in cities like Milwaukee. So, interesting conversation there. We're having an interesting conversation right now with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates. As we talk about home renovation and repair, we've zeroed in a bit on mold, but taking other questions as well. And Cheryl in Iron Ridge has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. You know, I heard the lady with the vent above the stove, and you know what the first thing is I thought of?
What?
Because I love to cook soup and stews. And the same thing happened to me. I was making chili one time in 4 pots on the stove, and that hood collected all the steam from the cooking pots, and all of a sudden the next day I had drip, drip, drip.
That makes sense, Cheryl.
So maybe she was cooking.
It could be. If she was up, 90-plus percent relative humidity— Yeah, you'd get condensation with very little temperature difference.
Yeah. Oh, it's a good idea, Cheryl. Thank you very much for that comment. I appreciate it very much. Although I don't do as much with soups and chilies this time of the year, but maybe she was. Who knows? Christina in Glenwood City, we'll go to you. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I live in western Wisconsin near the Twin Cities. Yesterday, I received some information in the mail about termite mitigation and inspection. And I didn't even think we had termites around here. And I figured since John is a professional inspector, maybe he could answer that.
There are termites in some parts of Wisconsin.
There are termites, and they were introduced.
Yeah.
So somebody moved up here from Alabama. I know La Crosse has got several neighborhoods with them.
Yeah. Yep.
And basically, they, you know, it's like the prairie dog in Wisconsin Dells that we're talking about last week. It rode along in a truckload of hay. Well, the termites came in a cardboard box with something in it. So we do have certain areas that have termites. My guess is if you go online and just Google termites in Wisconsin, that you're going to get a whole bunch of maps that Phil Pelletieri or somebody put together saying these are the neighborhoods and the cities that have a few termites. But generally, out in the country, I have never seen a termite out in the country in Wisconsin or in small towns. It's usually the large cities, and it's still sort of neighborhoods.
I think there's even a little patch in Madison that had termites for a while.
You could be right, Larry.
I think they were able to get rid of them. There's ways to do it to keep them from spreading from one house to the next.
Yeah. But what a good business to do termite inspection in Wisconsin. Yeah. It's sort of like doing dragon inspections. The people just pay you and you go, oh, no dragons here. We're fine.
Thanks, Christina. Appreciate the call. And would you something like that kind of infestation, there'd be some notice.
Well, most certainly we get calls all the time on carpenter ants.
Yeah.
Or people who are worried about carpenter ants because they see insects. So generally, when we've got a wood-destroying insect, we find out about it sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Pete in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Larry. Hey, John. Hey, another area that mold is a real problem in homes I've found is closets on outside walls. I tell people that if it's really, really cold out, leave the closet doors open and maybe even leave the kitchen cabinet doors open because that cold air pools back there and condenses. The reason why I called was a month ago we learned that those of us with septic systems and water softeners should not be putting the water softener recharge water into the septic systems. So I guess I'm getting a gray water discharge port, but I don't know what that looks like. So can you give me some advice on how to do that both legally and, you know, in practical consideration?
Oh, boy, I haven't done a gray water discharge report in years and years and years. So basically, there's three types of water. There's clear water, which is like coming out of your sump pump, and that you can discharge out on the lawn, should discharge out on your lawn. And then we have black water, which is what's coming out of our toilets. And then we have gray water, which does not have the big bacteria loads and things, but it still has other things in it where we don't necessarily want to discharge it on the lawn. And most gray water that I've run into, we can discharge on the lawn, but the problem is we've got salt in the water softener. So I'm afraid, Pete, I don't have a good answer for you. The question that I guess I would have as far as the septic system, and I'd probably talk to your local septic guy, is one, how much salt are you using, which depends upon your water use and how hard your water is. La Crosse, I don't know how hard your water is. I mean, here in Madison, it's terrible. But in La Crosse, I mean, there are places where the water is actually fairly soft because they're taking out of rivers. So the amount of salt that you have coming out of your softener, your septic may be able to handle that, but you need to talk to whoever does your three-year maintenance on your septic and discuss that with them.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to do it. Pete, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. We have some emails we should address here, too. Gail emailed us. The front door has a side light panel. The wood on the outer lower side has mold, and the drywall next to it is moldy.
Mm-hmm.
Do they need to replace the door side light unit? It's original with a 1960 house. Mm-hmm. Somebody suggested vinegar, but reading on the internet, it says not to use vinegar on stone. They don't see how to protect the stone floor from all vinegar, bleach, or whatever else they use on the wall.
Right.
The drywall's solid, so she wants recommendations.
Yeah, I guess if Gail were on the phone, we'd ask her whether this is a single pane glass, and it may be from the 1960s.
No.
If it is a single pane glass, it's got a really low UNR factor. It's down around 1, which means it's going to condense as soon as it gets chilly outside. So the answer there, you know, unless this is a historic house where it doesn't fit in or something, is to take a look at a new side light system, maybe even a door and side light system. where we've got, I would look for a U23 or small. The lower the U number, Larry, the better the thermal resistance. So like a U20 is really good. A U30 is not so very good. Not very good at all. So you may just have to do that. And again, humidistat, see how much humidity you have in the house. If the house is a little too humid, this is not the only place then that you're getting condensation. You could be getting it in the unseen places where you could get off-gassing from mold that isn't good for you.
All right. So maybe replace that whole thing?
Possibly. Yeah. You know, 1960 is getting to be a long time ago.
Yeah.
And certainly thermal efficiency of good quality modern windows, doors, side lights, et cetera, is really, really pretty astonishing. I mean, back there, we had a lot of stuff that was R1. Now we have a lot of stuff that's R8. Yeah. Now, that's 800% increase in thermal efficiency.
Yeah.
Big difference.
Big difference. Mary in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Hey, I had a question and a comment about the person that had an issue with water dripping from the vent over their stove.
Yep.
Canning season, you could produce a lot of steam in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, if you are running air conditioning and you have a stove vent that's running through a hot attic, will that cause condensation?
No, it should be the opposite. Because the warmer the vent is, the less likely it is. If the vent is warmer than the inside air, it is not going to cause condensation.
It won't condense.
Yeah. Now, you could end up with a situation where there's a duct right next to that vent, you know, going up to an outlet on the second floor that is actually the metal duct and the metal vent are close to each other, could be cooling it. But I think this is probably just a use. I know it's tomato season. We're canning.
Mm-hmm. We are indeed. There you go, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Alyssa in Appleton. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi. We just got mini splits for our house, and we like them a lot. The AC works great, but we're noticing it smells like musty, you know, in them. And I'm not sure why. It's our first year. We got it put in last fall, and so we're not sure why they smell funky.
Okay. They may need some cleaning. Do these have a filter on them or not?
They have a filter on the top, which we've taken off and knocked off. And then we have them draining, like, out the side of the house. So we can see the water dripping out. Oh, and we did notice a week or two ago that the water, I turned it off, and when it closed, it had water coming out the front, dripping onto the couch.
Oh, dear.
So that wasn't good. Yeah.
No.
And so my husband's like, turn it on. And we turned it on. And he's like, let it cool off before you just shut it off. And so we turned it back on and just bumped the temperature up.
Sure.
So it wasn't blowing cold anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't, but then the other one in the living room did leak or was dripping a month or so ago. So it seems to be a sporadic problem out of both different units, and then the funky air smell, I think, is coming out of both units as well.
Okay, I think you probably need to have your installer come back and take a look at these to make sure they're draining properly. Now, basically, what you have a mini split is it's like an automobile radiator. You know, you're blowing air across it, and it's transferring heat or taking heat out of the air when it's on the air conditioning mode, but you're blowing air across it. So you've got dust in your house, and that dust includes all kinds of things, including the skin we shed, the dog hair, you know, microscopic food particles. Well, when that gets stuck on that radiator and then we get some condensation on it, we basically have got organic debris we've made wet, and that's perfect for growing mold. So you may find that you are going to have to do some fairly regular cleaning. And I don't know how to check the dust level in a house. I'm sure there's an air test that does, but that's not a field that I'm in. But if you find that your house is fairly dusty, if you have a lot of pets, those sorts of things, those can cause mini splits to smell bad. And what you're smelling most likely is off-gassing from mold.
Oh.
So you probably have, because the musty smell that you have is actually a gas produced by mold.
Okay.
So your mini splits in your air are giving you a warning. So first, let's make sure the thing drains correctly. And then while the technician is there checking that, say, is it dirty? Does it need cleaning? How do I clean it? Because we don't want to damage that radiator, that heat transfer unit. So get a professional in to help you a little bit. Mini splits are wonderful. They do take some maintenance, but we're working with a heat pump, we're working with electricity, and they're quite efficient.
Yeah. There you go, Alyssa. Thank you for calling. And on to Evan in Platteville. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Larry. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've got a really beautiful 1962 ranch that's got a chimney on the exterior wall, and the flashing has been leaking a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen some drips in the plaster up around the roof, and there's a little musty smell that's coming out of the walls on mm-hmm. either side of this. So we know we need to do something.
Yeah.
And sometimes I dive into projects a little quicker than I should.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I would love some advice in terms of, you know, if we got a bunch of mold building in
yep.
there, what are the steps to approach this safely? Is it a DIY or should we call them the professionals?
Evan, what I'd like you to do, write down my email. Got a pen?
I can look you up online.
Look me up online.
I'm in a car
okay.
right now.
Here's okay. what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you to send me pictures of the chimney because the world has changed. In the old days, the way we flash chimneys doesn't work anymore. In fact, the way we flash like gables on houses over a roof below doesn't work anymore. And part of it is because of the increased rainfall we're getting. So the stuff that worked from 1962 to 2010 worked fine, but it doesn't work anymore. So I want to actually take a look at what type of flashing you have, and then I can send you a drawing. Because what we're doing now is rather than putting in a step flashing with a counter flashing over the top of it, we're doing a step flashing with a through-wall flashing. Because we're finding so many chimneys are leaking. Even though the flashing on the exterior was professionally installed in a traditional manner by a mason, the problem is the traditional manner doesn't work anymore.
All right. And your email anyway is...
Yes, it's real short, FREI at chorus.net. Chorus like a group of singers.
Fry at chorus.net.
Yes.
All right. There you go, Evan. Thank you so much for calling. Margaret emailed us. They have a handyman planning to replace exterior trim around the windows. Some of the windows are over 30 years old and some are 10 years old. The house is 100 years old. Should they replace or add flashing tape around the windows before putting on the new trim? If so, what kind of product should they use? And when a piece of trim was removed from one of the older windows, it looked more like tar paper than it did trim.
Really good question. That's exactly what I have in my house, tar paper.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to use with tar paper is you have to use a butyl-based tape, not an acrylic base, a butyl type. Ice and water shield is a butyl-type tape.
Okay.
The other thing that we find with tar paper is if it's been on there for 100 years, like in my house, it's really dusty. There actually are primers out there you can put on tar paper before you put the tape on. So you may have to go online and look at tape primer for tar paper. But find a good quality butyl tape. There are also tapes that are listed as tar paper tapes. I haven't used them. I've just used butyl tape.
Yeah.
But either of those will work. The stuff that works on, you know, Tyvek and blocks it, the acrylic tapes, doesn't work at all. It'll fall off within minutes. But yes, definitely tape those windows. It makes a huge difference as far as the amount of air and air going in and heat coming out. So do a real nice, thorough job on it.
There you go. Joe in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We moved into a new construction home last winter. It was our first winter in the home. The home is insulated with zip system on the exterior walls and spray foam insulation in attic spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And we noticed last winter that we were getting a lot of accumulation of water on the window sills. It was puddling in all of the first floor window sills. And we asked our builder and the insulation company about it, and they told us this was actually a good thing because it means that our house is insulated well and very, very tight. But it just makes me wonder, because there's water sitting on our wood windowsills. And to me, that just seems like it will lead to trouble.
Right. You are correct, and the builder's wrong. Now, just a moment ago, Larry and I were talking about building quality, and the lady called in about the side light. And so windows have a U rating, right? And the U is the inverse of the R. So if a window is a 0.2, that's an R5. So what you need to do is you need to get the brand of the windows. You can probably get that from the builder. And then you need to find out what the U factor is. Now, I've got a guy down in Evansville is putting in U30 windows. It gets down to 40 degrees outside, and it's condensing inside these people's houses because the windows, frankly, are junk. And unfortunately, there's nothing in the Wisconsin UDC that says the windows have to be, you know, U whatever. Now, Energy Star says they need to be at least 0.27, and I wish Energy Star would change that, drop it down to 23 or 20 or something. But it could be that you have glass in your windows that is not, does not have an adequate U and R factor in it. Now, the other thing, again, hardware store, humidistat, see what your humidity is. If your humidity in the winter is 65%, even good quality windows, you're likely to see some condensation. So make sure you're fairly dry. Now, new houses off-gas water for a long time. It takes like 8 years for your concrete walls in the basement to fully dry out. So your house may be a lot wetter now than it's going to be in 5 years. And this is why I want you to have a humidistat in so you know what you have. So number one, check with the builder. Get the brand of the windows. There was a slip of paper on the windows that gave the U factor, National Fenestration Rating Council, the IEC. There's a couple different rating councils, but it would have had those numbers. As long as it is at least a 0.27 or lower, you're good. Then most likely you've got high humidity. And, of course, last winter the house was even newer, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we still had water coming out of a lot of things. And you may not have felt it, but it may have been 65% humid in there. So you may not have a problem at all. So what you may have to do this winter, if the humidity gets higher, you may have to just run the bath fans longer, you know, run the hood fan in the kitchen, induce a few air changes, even though it's built nice and tight with the zip system. You may have to crack a window. But control the humidity, and it could be you have no problem at all other than you have a new house and they tend to be wet.
Joe, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. But get that humidistat. Do get a humidistat. Check that out as well. Chris in Appleton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I was calling because we have our house was built in 2004. And at that time, they installed a ventilation system, the DEC quiet vent. That has pooped out on us, and so now we're faced with, should we install something new, because I understand they don't make those anymore, this ventilation system, which we had one in each bathroom, or a timer in each bathroom, and then a timer in the kitchen. And we've been offered the a heat recovery ventilation system. I'm just wondering what your opinion is on whether we should do anything, or is there anything available that's not, because these are pretty expensive. I think $4,000 or something for these types of systems.
Yeah, the HRVs are fairly expensive. Without knowing a huge amount about your house, Chris, how the rest of it functions, it's hard to tell you whether you should simply put in a remote fan, you know, which would probably be anywhere from 500 to 1,000 CFM, the HVAC guy will tell you, so that all of your bath fans are venting. I assume you've got one vent in your roof where all of the fans in the house vent out, and this is sort of like an octopus system that all the little ducts go to one central fan, and that is exhausting the air for you. And you have a timer in each room because you can't even hear the fan if it's a good system. It's what I have in my house. I do not have a heat recovery vent system because my house is so inefficient, it wouldn't buy me anything. So I guess the question is, if you know how your house performs, you may be just fine without an HRV system. I mean, if it's an extra $3,000, that buys a lot of natural gas and electricity. And maybe you'd be just fine with simply having an evacuation fan without the heat recovery vent system.
Yeah, makes some sense. Chris, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Jonah in Ellington, your turn. Hi, Jonah.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I got kind of an odd question, but what are some tips you've got for hanging art in the shower besides don't do it? my fiance and I, we have a couple prints. Like, not, they're not originals. We're not hanging anything priceless. Essentially just glorified posters that we, like, taped to the wall and put a bunch of plastic over. And it lasted for about 8 months before it came off from, like, the steam. And we haven't had any – like, that's how long it took also to grow visible mold. Uh-huh. Do you have any tips for hanging stuff in the shower?
No. if Ken Adams, my old friend, went way back, was here, he'd say, "Don't do that." Let's buy a better quality print, put it in a frame, and put it out in the hallway instead. A shower, you've got water everywhere, you have humidity everywhere. No matter what kind of tape, plastic, etc., you use. You know, you have the grout grooves and things in the tile, unless this is a solid surface. But yeah, I would just not do it.
There are people who I've some friends who have art built into the tile. I mean, the tile itself
is art.
Is,
yes,
art.
Right.
And that's pretty.
It is. It is.
And it's
sure. Nice Italian hand painted or Spanish. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe do that. Let's invest in something else, Jonah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller with John Freiberger of Freiberger and Associates of Fitchburg here on WPR News. Talking today about your home with our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, by the way, you'll hear how to save your water-soaked garden. Plus, we'll talk about native plants, but that's tomorrow. Right now, it's your home. And Catherine sent us an email, John. They're planning on an addition to their 1960s ranch house in Madison. Be a simple one room, about 20 by 20 or slightly smaller. They want to make sure all structural elements are built well, but the room itself is pretty straightforward. They've spoken to four contractors so far and have two ballpark estimates that are extremely different. One is a big-name contractor, and their estimate was double the other contractor. They're still waiting for a couple of other estimates. Is it necessary to have a crawl space? Currently, there's a concrete patio in the place where they would build the addition. What considerations should they have for foundation and other structural components? And what factors influence pricing, by the way? How can they find a lesser-known contractor where the project would be in their middle range instead of a small job? Anything else they should consider?
Well, let's do the structural part first, because that's real straightforward. I have had people attempt to put slab on grade additions on houses. It doesn't work. It's basically the slab is going to move differently. So you need a frost wall. So that means at least a crawl space. You need to be 4 foot. The bottom of your footing needs to be 4 foot below grade. And as far as mechanicals and everything else, that's what you really need, because you need to get heat into there. And whether you've got a radiator system with pipes or whether you've got a forced air system, the crawl space is really going to make things work well. Make very sure that the crawl space is very well sealed. So even though it's a crawl space, I want a layer of plastic, you know, Visqueen, 6 mil, 8 mil, and then a layer of concrete over the top of that, because I do not want humidity coming out of the soil and then condensing on your floor and causing mold. So that's number one. As far as pricing, oh, that is really a tough subject. You get what you pay for. I could make a living just working with people who had new houses and additions put on where the job is absolutely awful. So really anyone in Wisconsin, if you are thinking about doing some construction work, do an awful lot of checking on the people that you're thinking of hiring. Now, in Madison, there are a couple of absolutely wonderful firms. And I also know that right now, if you talk to them, they're going to say, well, we can start that in September 2026. Mm. And that's the way it is, because most of the people out there are incompetent. And the difference between the good guys and the bad guys is 5 years of litigation. And by the time you're done with the 5 years of litigation, you're going to wish you'd paid double for it and didn't have the litigation. So check them very, very carefully. There are some good-intentioned people out there that simply don't have the skills. The other problem that they have is they're going to give the job to the low bidder. If you need brain surgery, do you want the low bidder or do you want the best surgeon? So, again, you get what you paid for. So any place in the state, check people out, see how long they've been in business. Go to the state has a thing called CCAP. You just Google lawsuits in Wisconsin. See if Green Brothers Construction has 8 different lawsuits against them.
Yeah.
And then read the Wisconsin Home Improvement Practices Act. I believe it's Act 110. That tells you the 7 things that have to be in a construction contract. Because the majority of construction contracts I see in the state of Wisconsin don't follow Wisconsin law. If somebody's handing you a contract that doesn't follow HIPAA, why would you go with them? Mm-hmm. So a lot of research. Don't be alarmed by high price, because high price hopefully means good quality, everything done to code. The other thing that I think this is the first time I'm saying in this program, we say it every single program, but download installation instructions on everything. If you're going to have a Tyvek weather-resistant barrier, download it, print it. When it goes on, look at it. We talked about windows earlier. Find out what the U rating is on the windows. Do not buy a U.30 window. Get good quality. So do your research. Little additions can cost $400 to $450 a square foot. That is a lot of money. If somebody's going to come in and do it for $150, that would worry me a lot.
Okay. All right. Jan in La Crosse, we're on to you now. Hi, Jan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Larry, I love your show.
Thank you.
I have 2 questions. I have windows in my house that need to be replaced. They are Anderson windows. I believe they were put in 1990, and they have wood on the inside and storm windows, aluminum on the outside. I want to get rid of the storm windows.
Mm-hmm.
The inside, they're double pane, and it is fogging up mm-hmm. with the humidity. So I did hear you explaining about the U factor, but I came in kind of in the middle of it.
Sure.
So I just wondered if you could explain that again. And then the second part is there is a window with a wood frame in the shower, and I can't for the life of me figure out why somebody would do that. And should I have that taken out?
Yes, I would take it out. And don't replace it with art, though.
No. All right. I heard that conversation.
So you want to make sure that you do your research. And again, as we said earlier, Energy Star wants a U factor of 0.27, okay? So that, now most people are familiar with R factor, because that's what we talk about. We talk about the R insulation in our walls is R19 or R21, the attics R28, blah, blah, blah. So if you do the inverse of that, that is about an R of 3.75, 3.8. That's a decent window. I would go better than that. That probably has 2 panes of glass and a low E coating and argon between the panes. Now, just with dual panes, if you go to a dual pane with a sunstop coating and argon, you can get as high as 0.24. And you can get double low E coatings and argon and get down to 0.20. So at that point, you're at R4.7, so you're 50% better than Energy Star. And that's maybe what I would look at, is look at the at a dual pane, two low E coatings, and argon. The system is called an HS1V-C180/i89.
Now, I'm sure you remember that.
And you can email me. You can email me. But now, Anderson still makes a good window. They make everything from very, very low end to very, very high end. Marvin does as well. So does Pella, and there are a couple other manufacturers out there as well. Some of them are quite expensive, but good quality, like Lowen out of Canada. And fortunately, you're in La Crosse, so you've got quite a few different dealers there. So really do some research, but tell them that you're really shooting for a U.202122 window, something in the R4.5 to R5 range, and then, of course, look at their warranties.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between a 10-year warranty, and there are some windows, I believe Lowen actually has a 20-year warranty.
Wow.
So, again, as we were talking earlier with Catherine, you get what you pay for. And depending on how long you're going to be in this house, if you're going to be in this house for another 30, 40 years, windows can be a good investment rather than being simple maintenance.
And that wood frame window in the shower, what are you going to replace that with? Same thing?
Well, maybe you don't even want a window in the shower.
Yeah.
I think that's probably where I would go. I mean, why do you want a window in the shower? No matter how good a quality window you get, it's going to be wet. The glass is going to be wet. And if it isn't from the shower head hitting it, it's going to be because your humidity is going to be 99% when you take a nice warm winter shower. So I would simply get rid of that. It's going to cost a lot less money to patch that wall nicely than it is to buy a very good window and put it in.
Would you use those to sort of, as a compromise, use those glass block kind of things or not?
No.
No?
Larry, I hate interfaces. In interfaces defined two ways. The first definition is where two different materials meet. The second definition is it's where it leaks.
So don't do it.
Don't do it.
Okay. Jen, does that help out?
Yes, I just, one thing you said look at, and I didn't get that written down.
Number?
A U factor as close to, .2 as you can get it. Now, if it's 2.1 or 2.2, that's still really good glass. 2.3 is good glass. But you want to exceed Energy Star, right? So when you talk to them, say, look, Energy Star is good, but I want better than Energy Star. Because I see a lot of problems with Energy Star windows. And it's not necessarily because of the windows, but it's the interface of humidity, the window installation, and the quality of the glass in the windows. So go for quality. Again, we're telling you to go ahead and spend a lot of money, just like we did with Catherine. But it's better to spend the money and have something you're really happy with.
And something you're swearing at.
Exactly.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense to me. Jan, I hope that helps you out. I very much appreciate your call. Our guest today, John Freiberger, registered home inspector. He's been with us for a long, long time now. Comes by every couple months to talk with us about home renovation and repair. Lots of callers online, but I hope we have time for you, too. We will take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we will be back with John. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Great to have you along today on WPR News. It's a home improvement day with our guest, John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. Great to have John back with us. We've been talking about moisture a lot and mold, but we're taking any kind of home improvement question. So if you need help with a project or question, I hope you'll join in. Number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones, John, and go to Julie in Wausau, Wisconsin. Julie, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. So I have an issue. I have a basement shower that is leaking, but it's not like it's leaking around the base of it. I never see standing water, but mm-hmm. the drywall is crumbling, and there's carpeting in the room next to the shower, and there's a little that gets a little bit wet. I can see behind the shower because where the piping is on an unfinished wall,
mm-hmm.
And there's no water there. There's no water there at all. We've replaced the shower door, so we know it's not leaking. Mm-hmm. We put in a really good fan. It's not that. And I also had a contractor out who ripped up the floor of the shower, the tiled floor,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't find anything wrong. So we are completely stymied. It only happens, of course, when somebody takes a shower there, but it's wrecking the bottom drywall, and there's nothing coming from the ceiling. It's all about water damage to the drywall right at the floor
mm-hmm.
and at the carpeting in the hallway just outside the shower.
Yes, well, it does sound like a bit of a mystery, especially since you've had a contractor already take a look at it. I mean, usually what we do if a shower is leaking is we run a bunch of water. You run it against the three sides, one at a time, if your shower head will indeed work that way, and then see if anything's loose. And somebody's gone around and tapped on all the tile and checked the grout to make sure that all of that is secure?
Yeah, they have, because then he retiled it all up, and it's all... I mean, it seems like the tile is functioning perfectly. The grout's all there. Nothing's chipped away.
Mm-hmm. And it has a tile floor. Is that correct?
It has a tile floor, yes.
Does it have a fiberglass pan or safing underneath the tile floor?
That I don't know.
Okay, if
that
it doesn't, it's probably leaking. So generally, now, when we build showers, especially with tile floors, is we put down what's called safing first. And the old stuff is sort of like EPDM roofing material, black rubber.
Hmm.
And you actually had a two-part drain. So the safing drained into the drain, and then the upper part of the drain after you put the tile floor and the tile drained into the drain. Because the assumption was tile floors will leak. Therefore, we put safing underneath it. Now, a lot of old showers had, like, cast, the old Fiat cast bases and things. Well, those didn't leak, but we still put safing under them. So if there's no safing, you've probably got micro leaks. And the only way to cure that is to take out the floor and put in a new floor with safing. Ask that question of the contractor and see if he knows the answer or can find it out.
Yeah, that sounds like it could be the case. Julie, good luck. Thank you for calling. Al in Kaukauna, we go to you. Hi, Al.
Thanks, Larry. And the question I have is this. I have a 90-some-year-old two-story double brick house that has a brick foundation. I've got efflorescence along a couple of different walls. I'd like to know basically what might be causing it as well as the remediation for
it. Right. And the building is only 90 years old, Al?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, 1937.
Okay. And it's brick, clay brick, or is it concrete brick or concrete block?
It's clay brick.
Clay brick. Okay, that's very unusual. I find clay brick foundations back Civil War and pre-Civil War. Very unusual to have a clay brick. And then the question is what type of clay brick it is. 1937, mm-hmm. It could be a soft clay or it could be a hard-baked clay. Again, you may want to shoot me a photo. I know quite a bit about brick foundations, but trying to answer your questions without seeing a photo is sort of difficult. Now, all masonry foundations leak. Well, all concrete foundations leak, too. All foundations leak. Let's put it that way. And if they don't leak liquid water, they are leaking water vapor. We have acids in our soil in Wisconsin, so that acidic water vapor goes through the brick, leaches out minerals, and deposits that as efflorescence on the inside. other than digging out the whole foundation and putting safing on the exterior, treating it like the base of a shower to keep all the water away, the best thing we can do is make sure that we've got good gutters, good downspouts, and a half inch of pitch for at least 10 feet around the house. That is 5-6 inches of drop for 10 feet. If the walls are still in good condition, efflorescence takes a long, long, long time to really damage something. So send me a couple of pictures, Al, and let me take a look at them, and we can talk a little bit by email and be happy to help you with that.
So it's FREI at chorus.net.
That is correct, Larry.
FREI at chorus.net. There you go. Al, thank you. Samantha in Independence, your turn. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I was just wondering, I've got a neighbor who, a church member that is going into a nursing home, assisted living sometime soon. But anyway, him and his son are thinking of like adding some, like a deck and some other stuff. Now, what would be the best stuff they could do to increase the value of their home so he could sell it? I think it was built in the 60s. It's just got the...
Okay. So we've got a home that... thanks, Samantha. So we've got a home that was built in the 60s. They want to sell a home, and they're wondering how they can best add value. Would it pay to add a deck on the home or something else?
This is not a field in which I'm an expert, but what I would suggest, Samantha, is to talk to people that you know who have bought or sold a home and then get the names of three real estate brokers that they recommend. Have the people list the home and say, here's what we're thinking of. What do you recommend? My guess, and this is only a guess, is they're going to say, Samantha, the way the market is right now, just list it.
Yeah.
Because the problem is, I've seen people put new kitchens and new bathrooms in a house, and somebody buys it, and they tear out the kitchen and the bath, and they put in what they want. So sometimes an investment is not an investment. It's a waste of money. But the professionals out there are the brokers, and they're the ones who really are going to be able to tell you what you're going to get for a return on any investment. And they may say, hey, paint the living room, paint the outside, trim the bushes, and that's it. Do $300 worth of work, and let's put the house on the market because the market is wonderful.
Yeah, I think that's... Just went through that with a sister's home, and we, rather than do any of the work that it really needed, we kind of cleaned it very well and trimmed, did exactly as you said. And I think it took, well, it took 2 days, I think, to sell the house.
Yeah, what we have to remember, Samantha, is that people don't want to buy your house. They want to buy their house. In other words, your house converted to how they really want it. And their taste may not be your taste. So as Larry said, a little quick cleanup is probably what the broker is going to tell you. But talk to the professionals because they're going to give you good advice.
Yeah. There's going to be a little, the guy's going to be putting in a new kitchen and a new bathroom and all that. And I just avoided all that. Now he's doing it the way he wants to.
Exactly.
Bo in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Bo.
Hello. Love the show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. So I kind of have a similar question to the other guy. I have a 100-year-old 1919 bungalow here in Washington Heights, and I'm redoing the basement because all the paint along the cinder block walls separated from the brick, like got moisture behind it and all that sort of stuff. And I'm trying to prevent that from happening again. And I hear something about breathable paints and primers, and I'm just trying to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, there are some breathable ones. There's a couple ways of approaching this. One is with a paint. Most paints are latex-based. Sometimes they breathe, sometimes they don't. The other thing that I spent the last 2 winters redoing my 1851 basement, I tell you, it looks absolutely beautiful. And what I did, I used 1851 technology. I whitewashed it.
Oh.
So look up whitewash. And I made my own. It's very simple. You hydrated lime water and a little bit of bonding. And, yeah, you'll still get a little bit of efflorescence through it, And it is so easy to touch up. You just take a little powder, throw it in a bucket, add some water. So look up whitewashing and see if that might work for you. Because the nice thing about it is you can mix it a little heavier, make it a little bit lighter. You know, it's sort of like it's the paint. You can adjust the thickness and viscosity of it. So if you've got an area that looks particularly bad, you throw in a little more lime and you make it a little bit thicker. But take a look at that. Just read about it online in traditional masonry and see if that'll work for you. Very, very inexpensive. You're looking at probably a 80-pound bag of lime for $30, you know, water out of your kitchen tap and some Elmer's or Acryl 70 or Acryl 60, some sort of bonding agent to help it stick. But extremely inexpensive and probably is going to last a lot longer than even the best paint you can buy.
Don't forget the paintbrush. There you go. That's going to save you a bunch of money. It's worth looking into, Bo, for sure. Jackie in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I have a question. Our home is about 48 years old, and we remodeled the basement. And at the time, the circuit breaker was just on the cement wall. And my husband renovated it and put a bedroom in there, and the circuit breaker is in the closet. Ooh. Is that okay?
No.
No, that's not good.
What do we have to do there?
Probably nothing. The city is not going to come in and say, you have a National Electrical Code violation, you've got a breaker in a closet. Way back when, pre-1960, you could have breakers anywhere, or fuse boxes more likely back then. But the code's been changed. Now, there's a certain, and I'm not an expert on the electrical code, but there has to be a certain number of square feet in the room to make it a room to have the breaker in. But as long as it's safe and as long as it's accessible, just leave it. If you ever sold a house, I would put on the real estate condition report that the breaker panel is located in a closet which current code doesn't allow, and leave it at that.
Yeah.
But why spend money if it isn't broken?
It's not going to be a danger.
As long as you can reset the breaker, you're fine. But, you know, you don't want to be digging through the canoe paddles and everything else to be able to get to the breaker box. So just make sure that it is accessible. If you have to, cut off the clothes rod so it doesn't come within 2 feet of the breaker box. But, you know, don't spend money moving the whole thing. I mean, maybe some year you're going to put in a whole new kitchen, you need more circuits, and then the breaker panel is going to get moved, and where that breaker box is now is going to become a sub-panel. But don't spend money at this point if you don't need to.
Jackie, there you go. Jerry and Kokana, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Yes. John, here's what I have going on, and just give me some advice if you would, please. I have a 15-year-old refrigerator that the ice maker is leaking. But the refrigerator still runs. My plan was just to shut off the saddle valve, which it has, that was installed, of course, by the appliance department to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, I can't get that saddle valve to close up tight, plus the gasket seems to be falling apart also, so I think that would be a problem in the going. And so my plan is to do this. Install a new saddle valve, but leave the line to cap it off so that I don't have that water line going to the fridge at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a compression T would be much better, but right now my skills are just to replace the saddle valve.
Right.
Any thoughts on that, and how do I make sure I get a good seal so that outlet valve from the saddle is completely shut off?
When you get the saddle valve at the hardware store, it's going to have a brand on it. Make sure you go to the website, download the installation instructions, which are going to be very brief. You're going to basically shut the water off, depressurize that pipe, probably drain it, put the new saddle valve on. And then at that point, you're just going to see if the valve indeed holds. And that's about all you can do. I don't think that they recommend any primers or gasketing or anything else, but I could be wrong. And that's why I want to send you to the manufacturer's installation instructions. Does that help, Jerry?
Thank you so much, John.
Certainly.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sandy emailed us. They have a 2-flat built in 1904.
No problem with it being too tight. It's so dry in the winter, they've considered adding humidifiers to both units. They have separate furnaces. Have seen very mixed reviews about humidifiers and wondering about your opinion.
Yeah, humidifiers deservedly get mixed reviews. I was in a house that had terrible mold problems. It was brand new. The humidifier was turned off, and it was running water full stream. So, and this was brand new. Sandy, let's maybe spend a little bit of money first. And this winter, let's hire an energy inspector from your area. And if you go to Focus on Energy and type in your city, you'll get a couple of people. They're going to come in with a calibrated fan and with thermal imagers. They're going to tell you how much leaks, how much heat loss you have, and then they're going to give you a whole bunch of suggestions for tightening it up. Because rather than spend money on humidifiers, maybe we need to spend some more money on some sealing and some insulation and things where those two furnaces are going to take 20% less fuel next winter. So let's start out with a little bit of science, and a Wisconsin-certified energy inspector is the way I would start. And it could be that the humidifier question simply goes away because we get it tight enough that it isn't dry all the time.
Yeah, yeah, makes really good sense. And they'll point out every place.
Oh, yeah, they're wonderful. And they will give you colored pictures, but walk around, tell them you want to watch over their shoulder. You'll actually see the studs in the wall because they're going to be a different temperature than the voids with the insulation.
Cool.
You'll get so much information out of it, and it's all very intuitive. It's not like you need to read instructions. Just walk around with them, show a lot of interest, carry on conversation, and the amount of information you'll get about your building for $400 to $500 is absolutely astonishing. Also check for rebates. And if this is a commercial two-flat, look at Focus on Energy for any improvement and other rebates. It could be you have really old furnaces. These furnaces are chimney vented. They're sucking air out of the house all winter. They're old. You go to condensing furnaces. You're going to go from 80% to 98% efficiency. You're going to reduce the air changes. So there's all kinds of things, Sandy, that you may be told by this energy inspector that is going to make your life easier, your utility bills lower, and the units more habitable.
And typically they'll give you a list, and here's where you start. This is the thing you need to do right away.
Right.
This is the thing you need to do later. This, when you get a little more money,
prioritization, right.
There you go. Jean in Sun Prairie emailed us articles that she has read say that contractors should use the Residential Load Calculation Manual, or Manual J, to determine the correct size for a heat pump. The house they built in 1987 and the total finished area is 2,300 square feet. They have added insulation based on a Focus on Energy evaluation since the existing 80,000 BTU furnace was installed. They have three contractors out for quotes on heat pumps. None of them use Manual J that she was talking about earlier. One contractor gave quotes on a 2.5-ton and a 3-ton heat pump. How do they know what the best size is? Should they expect to have a Manual J evaluation done?
Manual J is one way of evaluating the heat loss. And it's sort of a cut and paste system. I would simply talk to the contractor and say, how did you come up with that number? And they are going to show you, here is our BTU loss, and then what's their delta? Is it? And the thing is, deltas are changing in Wisconsin. I think we used to calculate it to 30 below zero, and then it went 25. And I don't get into this a lot, Larry. I know enough to ask the questions and enough to tell our caller that she should ask the questions. But sit down with the contractors, and you do not want to oversize a heat pump. If you can get away with a 2.5-ton, you certainly want to, rather than put the money into a 3-ton for the general efficiency, because you've got all that unused capacity.
Sue emailed us. Sue has 8x8 posts, red pine, she's been told, supporting a porch roof. She sees flying insects, etc., going in holes they drill into the interior of the posts. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to seal these posts to protect them from here on out?
Yes, there actually is. I wish I could remember the name of the product. Oh dear. I actually used it on some old carriages that had powder post beetles in. One of the toughest things in the world to kill. So, Sue, you're going to have to email me, and I will look at the bottle, and I will send it to you. And if you brush this stuff on, if it kills powder post, it's going to kill everything else, and it seals the wood. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. I know it's really expensive, like a pint bottle is like $30 or something, but it really does work.
And that's Frei, F-R-E-I, at chorus.net.
Correct.
For the email. Catherine from Marshfield emailed, what humidity level should you aim for in your basement using a dehumidifier?
Well, I aim for 40%, and I usually achieve it even with an old stone foundation. Make sure you've got a good quality dehumidifier. You know, get one that, rather than have to dump the bucket all the time, that you've got a hose discharge going to your floor drain or to your sump pit, because it is clear water, so you can discharge it. But I would at least shoot for 40%. That's what I keep mine at all over the house, in my barn, in my basement, all over the place. And with a high-quality, efficient dehumidifiers I have, it seems to work.
Another listener emailed, how much concrete foundation can be exposed above grade energy and meet energy code?
Any concrete foundation that is currently exposed above grade needs to have insulation either inside or out. And I believe it depends upon the part of the state you're in. And you can look at the Uniform Dwelling Code, but in this part of the state, I believe we're putting R10 on everything. That can go on the inside or on the outside. On the outside, we're usually using 1.5 or 2 inches of foam, and they're covering that with a cementous coating so that animals and things don't get into it. But also, we want that foundation insulation to go below grade. So if you're doing it on the outside, we're digging down a few feet. As you get below grade, you get less and less heat loss. The other thing is you can put it on the inside. The inside can be done with blanket type, where basically it's fiberglass insulation inside a breathable vinyl blanket. So there are a lot of things out there. So I would Google foundation insulation and then see what works for your particular home.
There you go. And one final quickly, maybe. Do you have suggestions for air conditioning a large, heavily insulated workshop? It's 2,200 square feet, 26,400 cubic feet. Has radiant heat, no ductwork, or maybe reducing the humidity, if not the temperature?
Well, certainly it is going to be a lot less expensive to reduce the humidity. The problem that we have with air conditioning places like workshops where we're producing all of this dust is filtration systems. So we have to add pretty good filters, HEPA filter preferably. So then we've got to have a bigger fan. It starts getting expensive. So why don't you start with a high-quality dehumidifier and see how that works. If that makes it relatively comfortable, let's go with that. Yeah.
There we go. John, always a pleasure. You'll be back in a couple of months, and we'll do this all over again.
Indeed, I will.
It's John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Freiberger Consulting is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Coming up, we are going to take a look at mass timber construction. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to mass timber. It's engineered, load-bearing wood. It's emerging as a building material alternative to steel and concrete. And you can find it in buildings right here in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. The latest mass timber project is called the Edison. It's in Milwaukee. It's an apartment building that will be completed by 2027, and it will be the tallest mass timber building in the U.S. Larry Mueller here talking today about it. It's sustainable. architecture, really. And Alex Timmer is our guest. He's an associate professor of architecture and urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. And as we talk with Alex, I want to hear from you. Join in with your questions about mass timber or other sustainable models for architecture. Let us know your ideas for kinds of buildings you'd like to see in your town or city. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Alex Timmer, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Excited to talk about mass timber.
What does it mean if a building is a mass timber building?
So we would typically classify mass timber building as something that's predominantly made with engineered lumber. So we have effectively two major types. We have CLT, which is cross-laminated timber. And think about this like plywood, but it's constructed out of 2x6s of spruce, pine, or fir. The other type is glulam. Glulam is in contrast to CLT, where the layers of wood that you're gluing together all go in the same direction. So we typically see CLT as floor plates, roofs, walls, all load bearing.
Yeah.
And then glulam as beams and columns.
So what it makes it much different, I guess, from the more popular building materials.
Well, I think it's for us here, it's a relatively new technology. And so we're seeing both the need for like the industry to sort of get behind it in terms of the number of factories we have and these types of things. But it's a really compelling material, both from its environmental, it's constructed or let's say fabricated out of a renewable resource, out of something that we grow here in Wisconsin, for example. In Wisconsin, I believe the number is around 20% of our forests are spruce, pine, fir, the mm-hmm. types of wood that can readily be used in CLT. And we have a lot more hardwoods. And so there's some question about, can we leverage our hardwood for this as well? That's not something that has been sort of standardized or codified quite yet. But it's a material that is great because it can be fabricated offsite. So because you're fabricating a panel, let's say a floor in a factory using CNCs, using routers to cut it out, you can pre-plan every hole where every piece of plumbing needs to go, where every piece of electrical needs to go. And so that really reduces on-site construction time. It reduces on-site waste. It allows you to be constructing basically related parts of a building at the same time because a lot of it's happening in a factory offsite. So
a dry factory. A dry factory.
Yes, yes. In a controlled environment that's dry, you're not having to deal with the weather and those types of things. Other benefits of it's light. I mean, it's relatively light. Building materials are heavy generally, but it's relatively light. And what you see with mass timber buildings is actually a reduction in the concrete foundations because the timber is lighter to, let's say, a comparable concrete or steel building.
It's pretty cool. What are some examples of mass timber buildings maybe here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I could talk the most notable ones right now are the Ascent and the Edison. And the Ascent, until the Edison is complete, is the tallest hybrid mass timber building. So because it is a concrete core and the rest of the building is made out of that timber product. Until the Edison gets built, which I believe will be 31 stories, sort of topping out over the Ascent. So it's really fascinating to see here in Milwaukee, two of the tallest mass timber buildings in the world, one after another. It's a really special thing for the building industry here. And it's made possible, I think, really because of the support happening at both the state level and from developers and the architects and the engineers. Like, everybody kind of has to get together on this, because until very recently, it was an exception in the building code to do a mass timber building that tall. You see a lot of other, Wisconsin has 40 either constructed or in construction mass timber buildings, 15 in the design stage at the moment. And the vast majority of those buildings are between 1 and 4 stories. So we're talking about relatively low rise buildings. And that's really what makes the Ascent and the Edison, these really sort of compelling outliers, because they show what we can do.
So I remember I was reading a piece on the Ascent, and the builder was talking about, I forget how, he said normally we'd use about 40 people to build this under normal construction, but this was, we I think it was 15 or 18 people is all it took.
Yeah, it's a big part of being able to pre-manufacture the components of the building means that a lot of the coordination happens ahead of time. Meaning if you have somebody fabricating a floor plate in a factory ahead of time, like you have to be coordinating with the engineers, you have to be coordinating with the plumbers ahead of time, and then it all gets cut out. And think of them as they're components. They assemble in a very specific way, and they have all of their connection plates pre-assembled. So it literally comes to the site. It needs to be put in place and either bolted. Maybe something that's important to mention is a lot of times with mass timber, you see a steel connection plates between the components, so you're bringing in a CLT panel, for example, to the site, setting it where it needs to be, and either welding it or bolting it in place through a connection plate that's like placed in the CLT. So when it comes to the site, it's kind of ready to go. You set it in place and keep moving.
Kind of like, the process, kind of like a prefab house, you know, that we've had.
It's very similar. The difference is you're not bringing in, at least in the Wisconsin context, we haven't seen any projects in which they're manufacturing like an entire room. In Europe, there are some examples of like an entire room being built in the factory and being set down like a cell and basically literally like stacking boxes. We haven't seen that yet, particularly in the example of the Ascent, that's post and beam with CLT floor plates on top of that.
And it's beautiful. You know, you mentioned Europe, and mass timber buildings are more common in European countries, if I'm not mistaken. What are the challenges to building with mass timber in the U.S.?
So the biggest challenge, it's as with anything, there are multiple sort of variables that you have to contend with. The first variable is the building code. And until, I believe, on September 1st, Wisconsin will be adopting or beginning the process of adopting the 2021 IBC, which means International Building Code, and IECC, which means International Energy Code, that we'll be adopting and sort of onboarding those. What's really important about that is it has built into it a subsection specifically about mass timber. So before that adoption, we were working on the 2015 code, and a lot of the mass timber buildings had to work on exceptions through the building department. So that's super important, because that then clears the way for developers to take a risk on a product, on a construction technique that's not super common, because they can avoid having to deal with the sort of additional timeline of getting exceptions to the building code. And then what we're seeing, which is really exciting, and I think if you look at the number of buildings, we're on this kind of exponential curve, because every time we build a mass timber building here, we develop expertise. And that expertise then makes it that much easier for the next engineer, architect, or whoever to build the next one. So we've hopefully in September, we're kind of past that kind of, let's say, the building code side of things. And then we get into the question of sourcing material and fabricating it. So I got to remember this number correctly, in like the Great Lakes Basin, I think you could argue as of 2023, we had 4 plants that would make mass timber. We have one in Wisconsin here. I'm blanking on the name, but they specialize in glulam, right? So they're not doing CLT. They're primarily doing glulam. And so as we're starting to see the sort of, let's say the legislative side of things make it easier for developers to do this, we're starting to see the need and desire for producing more and more of this product here in the United States, which is great because it means more jobs and more factories, and we become more of an expert on these things.
Yeah.
The next thing then is the sourcing of the material and making sure that you're pulling from forests in a sustainable manner. Whether it's, you know, FSC or if it's SFI or PE, these different certifications that make sure that you're managing the forest sustainably where you're pulling these materials from. Otherwise, you do run the risk of effectively having an, even though it's a great material and it's, and you know, it's ecologically great, but it could have a negative impact if we're not sustainably managing the way that we pull that material from the environment around it, the way we extract it. So I think it's those three things, and it's really exciting to see the legislative part of it happen, and we're seeing more and more of these projects come on board.
I'm telling you, I look at that Ascent building, and it is beautiful, gorgeous building, and it's 280 feet tall. I mean, that's getting up there, and the Edison's going to be taller. They're both apartment buildings. What are the are there risks to building so high with wood?
Well, I think the biggest thing that comes up is the question of fire, and the way in which wood is a combustible material, and the building code deals with it by dividing, let's say, mass timber building into three subtypes. Technically four, but we'll talk through A, B, and C. And each of these subtypes, type 4A, 4B, and 4C, limit the height of a building and then require a certain amount of protection for the wood. So when you look at, say, a type 4A building, which is the tallest that that these buildings are, those buildings have to encapsulate or cover with non-combustible materials, typically drywall, for example, the timber so that it doesn't start on fire. When you get to 4C, these are lower buildings, four stories, in that kind of range, you can completely expose all of the timber. And the way in which engineers and the scientists that have been doing the sort of testing to develop this, what they do is they actually oversize a beam. So if you have a mass timber beam, you oversize the beam. And when it burns, it chars. It's called the char layer on the outside. And once it chars, it actually protects the wood on the inside of the beam. So yes, it could burn, but structurally it's sound because of that char layer effectively protecting the sort of inner portion of the beam that's actually been sized for the structure as it's required. I mean, I think that when you look at the Ascent, like I mentioned, it's a hybrid building. I don't remember the exact numbers. I believe it's somewhere around 20% of the timber is exposed in the units itself. And then when you start to move from the unit to the egress, meaning the exit hallways and the stairways, we're suddenly starting to see more and more drywall. And that's twofold. What it does is it makes sure that, like, when you leave your apartment, you have a sort of protected pathway all the way to the egress, and also so that firefighters have that protected pathway. And so the stair cores are concrete, and the podium or the base of the building is also concrete. So it's not a kind of one size fits all. And I think every use type, site and size of building requires sort of different conditions, but that's kind of how that sprays. So like the more you expose, the smaller the building needs to be.
Yeah. Alex Timmer, our guest today, Associate Professor of Architecture and Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee, as we talk about mass timber construction with him. Join in. Questions 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at mass timber building in the state with our guest from the UW-Milwaukee Department of Architecture and Urban Planning, Alex Timmer. He's an associate professor there. Join in. Questions 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Here we've got a little longer email, but I think it's worth reading from Ethan. His master's thesis was focused around looking at outlets for small diameter timber in Wisconsin. One of these outlets was CLT. He loves the idea of CLT. Wish it to become reality here. The biggest issue that very few of our trees are appropriate for use in CLT. The two timber species which contribute a majority of the overall growth in Wisconsin are white pine and red oak. White pine's a little weak to use in any form of mass timber by itself. Red oak is too dense to glue and heavy. Another consideration is that all other timber grown in the state has strong markets for other uses. CLT seems infeasible in Wisconsin due to current market condition, and he doesn't understand how it's more carbon friendly if we're shipping in the building from Europe as we did for the Ascent building in Milwaukee. So his question then is, what efforts are being taken to adopt CLT industry in Wisconsin? Since as it stands today, the forest products industry has yet to break into the CLT market within the Lake States. He would like to see the mass timber industry in Wisconsin grow.
It is a challenge, and I think that the species part of it is a good question. Like I mentioned before, the sort of suitable species only make up about 20% of our forests, the vast majority, or at least the last number that I was looking at. And so there is a question of having to do the testing to kind of expand those things. I will say that the work of the DSPS, the Department of the Professional Services, to get the 2021 building code through and approved was to directly address some of the things that your email was asking, basically recognizing that there's a kind of chicken or egg problem here, which is like we need the demand to build the buildings, and then we need to be able to open up a factory. To a little bit of backstory, a lot of those conversations that happened around that were actually around the same time as the closing of some of the paper mills. Historically, Wisconsin, what's really interesting about Wisconsin is we have in Wisconsin the first patent for a glulam timber product, which was patented out of Peshtigo. And I believe the building that they used to build that in is still up there. So it's the challenge. It's so multifaceted. And I think the work of the DSPS in Madison has at least recognized that there are certain levers that are certain things that they need to help with get out of the way. So the question about this is sort of sustainability question of it. Transport is a huge, he's absolutely right. The if you're shipping even by ship or rail, which are relatively low impact, but from Europe, you are lessening the sort of environmental benefit of a renewable resource because you're burning fossil fuels to get that here. To expand a little bit on that as well, the question of what happens to these buildings when we're done using them is really important relative to the environmental question. If we just take these buildings down and if they're burned or disposed of in a way that basically re-releases all of the sort of environmental benefit at the end of their life, we basically offset any good that we might have caused. So it's a challenge because we need certain dominoes to fall. I'm really excited to see the building code come up in to 2021 from 2015. I'm hoping that we'll start to see some of these other things sort of fall in place, like the industry coming here. And again, we do have, there are four or five plants here. So it's not that the industry doesn't exist. It's that the industry doesn't exist in a way to support the construction of a 31-story mass timber building.
Yeah. Well, this whole sustainability option, I mean, these buildings would be stored, and you kind of mentioned it in passing, these buildings would store tremendous amounts of carbon and...
Correct.
And would reduce fossil energy needed for construction over concrete, let's say, or steel or aluminum?
Yeah, I think so. The one of the most promising things about wood is its sequestration of what they refer to as biogenic carbon. So basically, as the tree is growing, it is absorbing carbon from the atmosphere and storing it in its structure. And the benefit of that from a carbon cycle standpoint is you basically slow down the re-emittance of carbon into the environment. So that's the question of end of life. End of life for a building, it becomes really important because if you just re-release that through burning or whatever, however we dispose of these buildings, all of that carbon that you've been storing and kind of holding back gets re-released. So you're absolutely right. I think anything that's biogenic, anything that is like naturally grown, it's that the promise there is that you're basically slowing down the carbon cycle, or sort of pulling back some of that carbon from that cycle rather than re-emitting it right away. It still takes, you know, energy to make these things. You have to harvest the wood. It has to sure. go to the mill. Then it has to go to the CNC, to the CLT factory, which is another, you know, type of mill. So there is still a lot of, let's say on the back end, on the producing side, energy used. But it is important to compare it to the other materials. One of the things we always talk about with our students is, you know, certain materials do certain things really well, right? Like timber, we don't really want to get wet, right? That causes sort of weathering mm-hmm. and wearing issues, certain, you know, versus things like concrete do really well with that. And so it's, I think the important thing and what I think is really exciting about the Ascent building as an example is as much of that building that could be mass timber was, right? Like maximize the sort of best possible use, maximizes the environmental impact.
You know, as you mentioned students, you think about architecture, it's more than just designing builds. It's knowing the codes, the politics, business and the supply chain, also thinking about how buildings affect communities and people's moods, also mm-hmm. sustainability. How do you prepare your students for this kind of work?
Architecture is, it's a delightful mess. I mean, it really is. It's so, maybe a bit of a pitch for architecture as a career, it's because you have to tap into all of these things, because you have to be aware of the implications of any one design choice that could be social or economic or environmental, you kind of have to be a generalist in everything and kind of dip your toe into a lot of different things. So through the education here, obviously we do focus on specific materials. And we do teach the students about building code and about the sort of environmental impact and the social impacts and like how all of these things are connected. Every project is unique, and what is going to be the most important sort of lever in that instance is different. And so it's the messiness of it is, I think also speaks to the impact that architecture has. Every one of us right now is sitting inside of a building, presumably, or lives in, you know, engages with buildings every day. It's a sort of an ever-present thing that as designers, you have to understand that the shape of your building impacts more. The choice, so something as simple as choosing how wide a space is will impact the span of a beam, which impacts the depth of the beam, which impacts the amount of material that you need to use and potentially impacts the specific material that you might choose. So it's definitely, we do our best to try and get them prepared to ask the right questions.
Well, and you have a lot of students?
Yeah, we are. The UWM is one of the what they refer to as the extra large schools in the whole nation. I believe there's only five or six in the entire nation accredited architecture programs that are as big as us. So we pride ourselves on that. We see ourselves as really wanting to make sure that we're broadening access to this as a profession because it is so impactful.
Yeah, well, this is fascinating. I hope people go online and just look up that Ascent building in Milwaukee to get a view of what it can look like and do. And Alex, you're doing some good work there. Thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it. Maybe we'll do this again. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Appreciate it. Alex Timmer, Associate Professor of Architecture and Urban Planning at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Great to have him with us today. Quick mention, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll hear how to save your water-soaked garden, and we'll talk about native plants as well. Thanks for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, all of our staff, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, thanks for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.